Hi, I'm Curtis Kelly, a professor of English in Japan. And the Brain Science Podcast has simply changed my life. And I'd like to say again to Ginger, thank you, thank you, thank you for bringing this information to our world and especially my world.
Welcome to Brain Science with Dr. Ginger Campbell. This is episode 130. As always, you can find detailed show notes and episode transcripts at brainsciencepodcast.com, and you can send me feedback at brainsciencepodcast@gmail.com. Episode 1 of Brain Science was released on December 5th, 2006, which means that for the last 10 years, I have been exploring how recent discoveries in neuroscience are helping unravel the mystery of how our brain makes us human. During that time, I have received emails from listeners from around the world, and today I plan to share a bit of that feedback with you. Curtis, who you just heard, was the only one who sent me audio, and I will play you more of his words later. So today is the special 10th anniversary episode, and as many of you know, my life has become more complicated over the last year and a half, especially since my husband Dennis died unexpectedly last summer. I'm now juggling two palliative medicine jobs, which is really restricting the time I have to devote to Brain Science. That's one reason why I've decided to break the 10th anniversary episode into two parts. Today I'm going to focus on the first 5 years of the show, which was essentially from 2007 through 2011. Now, I am not going to try to tell you every guest that's been on the show or every topic that I've covered. That would probably be pretty boring. If you go to the website there on the home page of brainsciencepodcast.com, there's a button. It says past episodes, and on that page, you will find a list of every episode. And I have tried to tag episodes so that you can find what you're looking for. But what I do want to do today is basically three things. I want to tell you a little bit about how Brain Science, formerly the Brain Science Podcast, came about. I am going to touch on some key ideas, and I'm going to talk a little bit about how the show has affected me personally, although that's something I'll probably talk about more in part two. Another special thing about today's episode is that I'm going to share listener feedback, which is something that I rarely put into the show. Today I'll focus on long-term listeners, and then next month I'll include feedback from newer listeners. So the first email that I'm going to share today is from long-term listener Dalton, who I don't think Dalton's ever told me where he lives. Here's Dalton's email. Over the years, your podcast, both reviews and interviews, have enhanced my life by supplying a broad and professional perspective on topics related to brain science. Perhaps the biggest impact your podcast has had on my life has been in helping me to keep my attention and focus alive and productive. As frontiers go, brain science is not exactly a new frontier, but it is still a frontier and one full of mysteries. All explorations made into frontiers are solitary journeys into the unknown. They are journeys made along the paths less traveled, paths that are strewn with a wide variety of challenges that impede progress. Around every bend and every horizon is a new dilemma. The view from every peak serves only to remind you, still no end in sight. And as you venture deeper into the frontier, the terrain before you only gets more difficult. Your podcast is both company and a helpful companion on a lonely quest. With it, I don't feel quite as alone as I would without it. I want to say something about Dalton because he is kind of special in the fact that not only has he probably been sending me emails for the last 10 years, he is also probably the most critical writer. He will tell me when he thinks an episode isn't up to snuff. He likes really technical, deep episodes, and sometimes when I do an episode aimed at general listeners, he is unhappy, which just brings up the challenge of creating a show for diverse listeners, ones with sophisticated backgrounds, and trying to reach regular listeners who are, might be entirely new to the show. So at any rate, Dalton always keeps me on my toes. And I appreciate him taking the time to write to me so many times over the years, especially to be a part of this 10th anniversary show. Now, needless to say, I couldn't include everyone, and I'm not going to read every email, but I want to thank everyone who has taken the time to write to me. Over the years, there have been many times when I thought about quitting, and your emails have literally kept me going. Over the years, I've gotten emails from listeners all over the world, and I still vividly remember emails I got early on from students in Italy and Germany. However, probably the funniest email I ever got was from a student, I think a college student, who said that he was listening to the show while playing a video game and got so engrossed in the show that he had to turn off the video game. Now, those of you who have been listening for a while know one reason why this is funny is because he was trying to multitask in a way that we know our brains really can't do. At any rate, that one has always stuck out in my mind because it's quite a compliment for somebody like me to realize they could get somebody to turn off their video game. Science is a tough niche for podcasting. Content's time-consuming to create, and it's hard to attract advertisers. In fact, recent Hall of Fame inductee Manon Fogarty actually started out with a show about science, but she changed over to Grammar Girl, which is what she's famous for, because she told me that creating science content was too hard and too time-consuming. In contrast, I want to take just a minute to give a shout-out to a couple of long-term science podcasters who do their shows independently. Dr. Kiki Sanford, whose This Week in Science is still going strong, and Dr. Pamela Gay, whose Astronomy Cast is also still going strong. They have both been podcasting longer than I have and have created many, many more episodes, hundreds of episodes more than I have. This might partly be because they both have co-hosts. If I had anything to do over again, it would be to have a co-host. So what makes brain science different from other shows? From the beginning, I have believed that it is possible to share complex ideas in a way that is accessible to people of a wide variety of backgrounds. But I don't do this the way that it's done in mainstream media. I don't water things down or oversimplify, and I don't rely on gimmicks and special effects. I trust the innate curiosity of my listeners. Listeners have consistently told me that they appreciate my clear discussions and the fact that I don't talk down to them. Non-scientists are able to grasp the key ideas, while scientists appreciate learning about work outside their own particular areas. Of course, if you aren't interested in how discoveries of neuroscience are unraveling the mystery of how our brains make us human, you'll go listen to something else. However, despite requests for solo shows, which is how the show started out, that is, without interviews, I think that the real strength of brain science is the many wonderful guests who have graciously taken their time to talk with me. I work hard to ask questions that help them share their key ideas, and their passion for their work comes through in a way that I would not be able to communicate without their presence. So I think brain science has three things going for it. First, how the brain makes us human is an endlessly fascinating topic. I think I do a good job of explaining complex ideas in a clear way. And listeners get to hear what science is really like from the scientists in the trenches. Now I want to share another bit of listener feedback. This is from Christiane in Antwerp, Belgium. Dear Dr. Campbell, I discovered the Brain Science Podcast in 2008 and took the opportunity of listening to all previous and following episodes. I have a background in biophysics and information technology. The last 15 years of my career, I worked as the head of an information technology department in higher education. I discovered that brain science really is the field where all my interests come together, which makes it so fascinating. My favorite episode was Brain Science Podcast 38 with Jeff Hawkins. When I compare the Brain Science Podcast with programs like the Brain Series of Charlie Rose, I really must congratulate you because I realize what limited resources you have compared to Charlie Rose. And I have paraphrased that slightly. Congratulations with the anniversary. Because I usually just get right into whatever topic we're talking about, I'm taking advantage of this special episode to talk about things that I usually don't talk about. And one of the things I want to do today is to share with you a little bit of the story of how brain science got started. The first thing I ever recorded actually became episode 2, which was a brief review of Jeff Hawkins' book On Intelligence. One reason that that episode was so short was that it was originally recorded for another podcast, The Sci-Fi Show, hosted by Jason Rennie. This was aired in the summer of 2006 and actually inspired me to launch the Brain Science Podcast in December of that year. My goal from the beginning has been to share accurate information about neuroscience with listeners from all backgrounds, although I must admit the show's actual audience is much more diverse than I ever imagined. The show quickly went from about 20 minutes to about an hour long, but the most important early change was when I discovered that interviewing scientists and writers was much more fun and less intimidating than I expected. But in the first 2 years, when I was producing 2 shows a month, I tended to alternate between book summaries and interviews. It was very common for me to discuss a book and then to have the author come on the show. It was a nice format because the author usually got to listen to my original episode and then they could fill in the gaps. I often tell people that the first 2 years of the show, which is through episode 52, is really a neuroscience primer because that was the period when I covered a lot of basic ideas, although the material was occasionally more technical. Near the end of the show's 2nd year, I attended the Society for Neuroscience meeting in Washington, D.C. I described the highlights of this in episode 50, but the meeting was also a turning point for me because I had dinner with a listener who suggested that I change the show to monthly. At first, I resisted, but I realized that there was a lot to be said for his proposal. I was working extremely hard to produce 2 shows a month, while even my most avid listeners were struggling to keep up. So the show went to a monthly schedule in January of 2009, and to be honest, I don't think it hurt our numbers at all. It made it easier for me to change to covering much more technical books, which is really my preference as time went on. The only problem with this monthly schedule is that it makes the show unattractive to most advertisers, who don't appreciate that many listeners listen to each episode 2 or 3 times. When I went to monthly, I began to focus more on interviews, although I continued to get requests for solo episodes. I am grateful that listeners appreciate my ability to explain the key ideas from the books I read. Early on, I made the decision to focus on current books, but even then, there's no way I can cover everything. My choices are admittedly idiosyncratic, and as the years have gone by, I've tended to pick more technical books with a preference for those written by working scientists and physicians rather than science journalists. Although I have a great respect for science journalism and I am proud to be a member of the National Association of Science Writers. Audible.com has been sponsoring Brain Science for over 9 years and there are more than 30 books featured on the show that are available from Audible. You can find the Audible links for these by going to brainsciencepodcast.com/bibliography. Of course, Audible also features over 150,000 titles from a wide variety of genres. So if you aren't already a member, I hope you'll check it out at audible.com/brainscience. So when I started out, I had a few key ideas that I really wanted to talk about. I wanted to talk about memory, emotion, consciousness, the role of unconscious, and brain evolution. But of course, along the way, I discovered a lot of new things like brain plasticity, embodied cognition, mirror neurons, the role of glial cells, to just name a very few topics. I've had many memorable guests over the years, but most of you probably know that my favorite all-time guest is probably Dr. John Rady. He was the one who explained why exercise is essential to brain health. And I think I have probably gotten more emails over the years in terms of episodes that have affected people's lives. John Rady has had a big impact because inspiring listeners to exercise is really valuable. Robert Burton also has been an important person in my life, and I'll talk more about his influences in a minute. I also really appreciated Dr. Fabrizio Benedetti, who is a leading researcher in the field of placebo effects, because as a physician, I have a particular appreciation for his research. Over the years, the focus of the show has really been sort of on these big picture ideas, but sometimes I get to talk to basic scientists and discover that their discoveries have important implications. For example, Seth Grant, who I've interviewed a couple of times and hope to have back on the show again soon, has revealed to us that synapses are much more complex than we ever imagined, and also that although the early compounds that are important have been present for a long time, this complexity has actually evolved with the synapse and with more complex organisms. Another important basic researcher is Dr. Eve Marder, who works with lobsters. She has really discovered that individual organisms may be more unique than we usually assume. Then I also talked with Dr. Guy Caldwell, who worked down the road from me at the University of Alabama. He is working with C. elegans, and it was very fascinating to learn from him how this tiny organism that has only 302 neurons is really essential to neuroscience research. Dr. R. Douglas Fields, who has written a wonderful book, talked to us about the fact that we now know that glial cells are not just support cells, but they actually participate in signaling. And then Miguel Nicolelis at Duke, who is working on brain-machine interfaces and how they challenged our assumptions about how the brain is organized. Now, these, of course, are just a few scientists that came to my mind as I was thinking about the past 10 years. I've also talked to quite a few philosophers over the years, including Dr. Patricia Churchland, who really was one of the pioneers of the idea that neuroscience should inform philosophy of mind. And then Alva Noe, who basically keeps reminding us, you are not your brain. There's more to being a person than just a brain. And Thomas Metzinger, who wrote The Ego Tunnel, who argues that all kinds of consciousness, including altered states, need to be included in a theory of consciousness. Another long-term listener is Luke from Canada, who has posted a long blog post on his website, cogzest.com, about how the Brain Science podcast has influenced him. And here is a quote from Luke. One of the problems on which I specialize is expert learning from knowledge resources with technology. The BSP, with its probing questions, rich hyperlinked transcripts, and audio and apt summaries, is a truly excellent cognitively potent trove of knowledge. Dr. Campbell highlights big ideas while also allowing us to revel in details. She regularly emphasizes the process of science. For example, the 2014 interview of Gregory Hickok on mirror neurons has many lessons for all scientists. She conveys the enjoyment and importance of science, stimulating and inspiring me. Thanks, Luke, and I will include a link to the entire blog post in the show notes. So what sort of key ideas stick out for me as I look back over the first 5 years of the show? As I said, I wanted to talk about memory, and I spent several episodes early on talking about Eric Kandel's work and the fact that the basic mechanisms are shared even by simple invertebrates like the aplysia or sea slug. But to me, it seems more important to realize that there are different kinds of memory that involve different parts of the brain, thinking back to the work of Brenda Milner. And most importantly of all, what stands out for me is the idea that memory is dynamic, which means it's not as reliable as we usually think. Basically, what this means is every time you remember something, you recreate the original experience in your mind. That recreation actually changes the memory because it incorporates things that have happened since the last time you thought about that memory. This has big implications. One story that stands out for me was when Dr. Robert Burton was talking about this famous Challenger study in which they asked some students right after the Challenger disaster to write down what they were doing when they heard about the disaster. Then a couple of years later, they went back and talked to them again, and they found that only 25% of them's memories matched what they had originally written down. One thing that really stuck out for me was the one story he told of one guy who they showed him his own handwriting, and he said, "That's what I wrote, but what I remember now is what really happened." Because that's how powerful our sense of sureness can be, even though we're not necessarily right. Early on, I wanted to share the pioneering discoveries of people like Antonio Damasio, who have shown that emotions play an essential role in healthy decision making. But this idea quickly merged with the realization that much of what our brains do is not only outside of our conscious awareness, but is not even accessible to our conscious thought. Of course, this has become part of a larger debate about free will, which I will save for another time. Then, of course, the work of Jacques Panksepp, another person who I've gotten many, many emails about, has demonstrated the subcortical origins of emotions. This has a lot of implications, and I'm really gratified to realize that over the last 5 years, Dr. Panksepp's work is beginning to get more recognition. My original interest in neuroscience actually grew out of my personal fascination with consciousness and the realization that it had finally become a subject of scientific inquiry. When I spoke to older philosophers like Dr. Patricia Churchland, she told me that she went into philosophy because early in her career, the study of consciousness was considered out of bounds for science. Obviously, this is no longer the case. Ongoing debate about the so-called hard problem of consciousness is fascinating because it is a place of interesting dialogue between scientists and philosophers. Over the years, I've done a number of episodes about the role of the so-called unconscious in decision-making. Besides the fact that most of what our brain does is unconscious, I think the key idea is to realize that being able to make rapid or gut decisions has an important role, but there's nothing magical about our intuition. That's why I published my short ebook, Are You Sure? The Unconscious Origins of Certainty, in 2010. The ideas in this book are not original to me. The book is based on the episodes I did about Robert Burton's book, On Being Certain, Believing You Are Right Even When You're Not. One topic I've always enjoyed reading about is brain evolution. Ever since I read Dragons of Eden by Carl Sagan back in the late 70s, I find it fascinating that our brains contain the story of our past, from our spinal cords, which we share with all other vertebrates, all the way up to the expanded cerebral cortex that seems to be unique to primates. I talked about this in quite a bit of detail in episode 47, which I still think is a good summary of what we know about brain evolution. Another thing that makes brain evolution endlessly fascinating is the question of what makes humans unique. Is language the last stand for human uniqueness? How important is it that humans be special? When I first covered brain plasticity in episode 10, it was still almost a fringe topic. But when Norman Doidge's book, The Brain That Changes Itself came out later that same year of 2007. This brought brain plasticity into the mainstream. I think that Deutsch is another one of the people who's been on the show who has had a great impact on listeners, because knowing about brain plasticity inspires people that have had various brain injuries, strokes, traumatic brain injury, and other problems. It has inspired them to realize that there is hope. And of course, the work of Edward Taub is an application of brain plasticity. Another topic that first appeared early on and which continues to be important to me is the role of embodiment and the field called embodied cognition. Here the basic idea is the fact that the brain exists in a specific body really does matter. The idea of a disembodied mind makes no sense from a scientific viewpoint. Without inputs from the body, the brain cannot create the world we experience. And each person or animal experiences a world that is totally dependent on their particular body. This has implications ranging from philosophy to robotics. Like I said, I've tagged these episodes with the term embodied cognition if you want to be able to find them. In 2008, I did an early episode about mirror neurons. These are neurons that fire both when an animal performs a motor activity and when they see that same motor activity performed. This has spawned all kinds of theories about things ranging from language to empathy, and some of these theories are probably not going to hold up. In the long run, I think the key idea may have been missed, which is, to me, that here we have discovered that neurons are not purely motor or sensory, that they can be both. This has many, many implications, especially to our understanding of how the brain is organized. Another long-term listener who graciously sent me feedback is Mark, who lives in Switzerland. This is what he wrote. First, your podcast is what I use to keep me inspired for my PhD dissertation, which is on art history and metaphor theory based in brain science. I needed you to keep me inspired. And then, of course, your model encouraged me to create my own podcast. In the future, I intend to do several short episodes, just lightly touching on brain science and art. Best wishes and keep up the great work. And you'll want to check out Mark's new podcast if you like, especially if you like a little short podcast. It's called Dr. Great Art. And I will also link to that in the show notes. So in the first 5 years, there were 80 episodes, what was at that time known as the Brain Science Podcast. And I know that my comments over the last few minutes barely touched the surface of all the ideas and topics that we explored in this period. But I do want to take a minute to talk about how my worldview was changed during this first 5 years. In part two, I'll talk in more detail, but for today, I'm just going to try to focus on the first 5 years. Embodiment is a big idea because it means that my view of the world is shaped by my experience as a female human being with my particular life experiences. The way I see the world is not the way anyone else sees the world. Secondly, my memories are not infallible. I have a sister who's only a year younger than me, and it's like we had two different childhoods when we talk about our childhood experiences. And this used to be a bone of contention, so to speak, between the two of us. But now I realize that obviously the implications that our memories are not as reliable as we think they are goes way beyond the relationships between individuals. It has implications for our court system and all kinds of other implications. And that's one reason why I have chosen to include it in today's episode, to encourage everyone to think about what does this mean in your life? which brings me to the third key idea that I wanted to bring up today, which is that even when I'm sure I'm right, I could actually be wrong. This goes back to the work of Robert Burton, but also many other guests on the show. He just kind of was more explicit about it. If our unconscious, what we've called our unconscious, or most of what our brain is doing is unconscious, well, I don't know that it has so much to do with the fact that a lot of what our brain does is unconscious, but just the fact that our brain does create a sense of certainty that we need to survive that is not necessarily reliable. And so the overall gist of this for me is, one, to realize that as a physician, a lot of times when I'm talking with my patients, you know, the way they see the world and the way I see the world are not the same. And trying to bridge that gap can be quite challenging. But just in our overall dealings and all kinds of ways in our lives, I think if people had a better appreciation for our cognitive limitations, we could perhaps be more tolerant of ourselves and of one another. In part two, one thing I plan to talk about is the evidence that human beings are wired to be social. And we'll also go over some of the other key ideas and guests that have appeared in the last 50 episodes.
Hi, I'm Curtis Kelly. And the Brain Science Podcast has literally changed my life. I'm a professor of English in a Japanese university involved in language learning. And you think about it, language and learning both need to be informed by neuroscience. But for some strange reason in our field, there's very little on neuroscience at our conferences, and even few graduate programs have much on neuroscience, the neuroscience of language and learning. So I realized, no one's going to teach me about neuroscience, so I have to teach myself. Unfortunately, because of my profession, I don't have time to read all the books on neuroscience. But that's when I found the Brain Science Podcast. And there, in 60 minutes, an interview with an author helps me zero in on the main points and then go to additional readings and studies elsewhere to learn more. And it was the Shanker presentation on bonobos and learning language that got me first. But there have been so many since then. I'm really interested now in Michael Anderson's neural reuse theories, because it shows how we learn sort of higher functions, including many in language. And then Bergen's embodied simulation. Wow, what a godsend that was. It really changed my thinking how we learn language, and I present on that all the time at conferences around Asia. And more recently, Andy Clark's prediction and how the brain's always predicting things. Because we use prediction a lot in teaching. Think about multiple choice questions. Or how about practice exercises that give students multiple choice questions with wrong answers? Aren't we really priming those students when they see those same wrong answers later in a test to choose those wrong answers again? So there's so much for us to discover and to explore. And so I do a lot of presenting now on things that I learned from the Brain Science Podcast. And again, I'd like to say, I'm extremely, extremely grateful to Ginger Campbell for bringing this to the world, to my world.
Naturally, I hope today's conversation will motivate you to go back and listen to early episodes of the show. Although the sound quality is shaky at times, I think most of the content is still relevant. There are two ways to get episodes that were posted before 2013, assuming that you don't already have them downloaded because you've been a long-term listener. The easiest way is via our premium subscription, which is only $5 a month. But you can also purchase individual episodes for $1 each at brainsciencepodcast.com. The easiest way to consume premium content is via the free Brain Science app, which is available for iOS, Android, and Windows phones. But you can also download episodes and transcripts directly to your computer if you prefer. If you're on a very tight budget, you can download all the content during the first month and then cancel your subscription. However, the main reason I have the premium subscription is that it provides an easy way for listeners to support the show. Before 2014, I relied on PayPal donations, which was not very effective. Of course, last year I added another option for long-term listeners who don't really need access to older episodes. People who donate via Patreon get new episode transcripts, which is why I encourage new listeners to get the premium subscription while they are working their way through the back catalog, and then later on convert to Patreon if they want to keep supporting the show. There is no doubt in my mind that I would have ended Brain Science back in 2014 when I started my fellowship in palliative medicine if I hadn't had a modest financial incentive to continue. However, when I decided to reduce the frequency of the show, I also decided to expand the free catalog from the most recent 25 episodes to everything released from January 2013 forward. This means you only need the premium subscription to get the episodes from before 2013. I just want to express my appreciation to all of the listeners of Brain Science Podcast and now Brain Science. Those of you who have supported the show financially, either PayPal, Premium, Patreon, those of you who have supported the show by sharing it with others, blogging, etc., those of you who have sent me emails to tell me how important the show is to you, all these things have helped keep me going. So before I close today, I want to read one more listener email. This is from Alex, who writes, "I have been listening to the Brain Science Podcast since 2007, and since then, it has been the podcast that I recommend to friends the most. For many years, I wanted to tell you how valuable your work has been to me personally, and I'm sure that it has been of immense value for so many others. Thank you for bringing neuroscience topics to a lay audience and for allowing both students and professionals to enrich and continue their science education. Your commitment in the last 10 years has truly been a gift. I feel that the Brain Science Podcast will have a lasting legacy on humanity, that in decades to come, when great minds are interviewed and asked about their educational development, they will reference the importance of the Brain Science Podcast. Thank you, thanks to all your great guest interviewees, and thanks to any and all who have contributed to this great work. Sincerely, Alex." I'm going to be sharing more listener feedback in part two of our 10th anniversary celebration, when we will, of course, look back at the next 5 years. In the meantime, don't forget to go to brainsciencepodcast.com to get show notes and information about getting all the back episodes. Don't forget to share this podcast with your friends. I don't advertise the show, so listener word of mouth is an important source of new listeners. I really appreciate you taking the time to be with me today, and I look forward to talking with you again very soon. Brain Science is copyright 2016, Virginia Campbell, MD. You can copy this episode to share it with others, but for any other uses or derivatives, please contact me at brainsciencepodcast@gmail.com. The theme music for Brain Science was composed and performed by Tony Catraccia. You can learn more about his work at syncopationnow.com.